This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. For Leslie and Allison Saar, having an established artist like Betty Saar for a mother meant that craft time was a little more intense than usual, but it probably helped them in their own careers as artists. Now, decades after those first popsicle stick statues and macaroni mosaics, all three Saar's women have their first gallery exhibit together. In it, they explore the relationships between intergenerational families, mixed-race identity, spirituality, and gender. They recently took me through their four-part exhibit at the Auckland Museum in Chapel Hill, where Betty showed me her first piece as a professional artist.
This is a color etching that I made in 1964, portraits of my three daughters, Allison and Leslie and Tracy. And it was before I got interested in assemblage, before my training in art had been in design with an emphasis on interior design, and this was my sort of way of crossing over into the fine arts.
You have the girls here in 1964. Did you know then that they would sort of jump off the canvas and become artists themselves?
No, I didn't even know if I was going to become an artist. I mean, I just made that. No. It's nice to have that, though, that to know that they found their calling and they're happy doing art.
Leslie, as you look at this now, do you think about the transition that you've made or how where you were at that time and whether or not you had any thought of becoming an artist?
I don't know if I had too much thought about that. I know I did not want to be an artist. I thought it showed a complete lack of imagination to do what both of my parents did. After the birth of my first child, I was home anyway and just sort of got into that way. So it wasn't a direct way.
You resisted it for a while then.
Yeah, I tried.
But you were in literature. You were doing writing.
Yeah
short stories and
poems. Yeah.
So what made you think that, was it the stupid little poems that drove you to art?
I guess, I don't know. I just, I really don't know. I started out by doing drawings and doing small books, and they just sort of evolved into larger works from that.
I started out doing graffiti, and that's how I ended up in this business. So how about you, Alice?
I guess I would agree with Leslie that, art was not my first love, although I think we're always doing it. But I think when you're making things all the time, you don't really think of it as a career. It's just something you do naturally. But I agree, when I was in high school, my mother, I think, got her first National Endowment, and it was kind of a long shadow to creep out from under. And so I think we were both, I mean, I don't know, I just really felt intimidated by her success. And it wasn't until, again, when I was doing my master's thesis and trying to get away with being an art historian, and I kept inventing things, that I realized I really should just make art as opposed to making up falsities in art history.
So we're in a section of this exhibit called Family Legacies. So why don't we take a look at some of the earlier work. And Allison, why don't we start with one of yours? You said you started out doing work on canvas or painting and then moved to sculpture, did you?
I worked a little bit with, I think I started out when I was in school doing fiber art, and which was very big in the late 70s. And I did my graduate work at Ozart Institute, and like I think it was maybe the last few months before I was getting out of school, and I'd already had my MFA show together, and I borrowed some chisels from my father, who's an art conservator, and got a block of wood and started carving. It was the first carving I've done. Somehow I managed to get through 6 years of art training without doing any carving. And it was really, it still looks a lot like the 4x4 it started out with. But I tried to incorporate some early influences. It's got mosaics in it, which was an early influence from the Watts Towers, which my mother actually grew up. Your grandmother lived there, right, Mom? And so she actually used to see Simon Rodia working on the piece, and so it had really early impression with me on me. And so I liked, so he's got this mosaic, so it's kind of paying tribute to that and the idea of making art.
Mm-hmm. Let's describe it a little bit. First of all, the title is in French.
Yeah, it's Si J'étais Blanc, and it's which is the title of a song by Josephine Baker saying, "If I were white." And so I think really within the realm of the exhibit, it really talks about identity. And for myself, it's always been kind of the reverse, being light-skinned and kind of more associating with the black half of my family.
Your father was an artist and a conservator, and he was white.
Right, yeah. And then, and so, you know, I just kind of took that song, and then, so what we're looking at is basically a figure, he looks like a puppet, so he's kind of like, I think, manipulated in the sense, too, that if he were white, that he would necessarily be prey to other people's whims and things like that.
And he has, he's obviously a black man from the waist up, that is clear, and his chest is open, and in fact, it's a cabinet-like arrangement, almost like a medicine cabinet, and inside, shards of glass coming at odd angles, looking like teeth almost, at his, right at the very center of his chest.
And the glass is painted white, so again, it's this sort of bittersweetness about whether, you know, the color of your skin really is what you want to do. If you aspire to be white, what does that really mean? And if you look beyond that, there's an image of Josephine Baker beyond all the broken glass. So.
And Leslie, you were also examining identity and mixed race identity in this painting called Me, Myself, and I, Identity Crisis.
Yeah, yes. Kind of being in college in the early 70s when the whole Panther movement was big and everything, and I had a hard time sort of going back and forth between both worlds, you know. And so when I started doing my art, I decided just to stick with the mulatto identity, which was really not very politically correct. Then it was kind of being uppity, I suppose, if you called yourself that. But I really basically appear completely white. So I just thought there wasn't a whole lot of honesty in just coming from an African-American perspective. I wanted to be honest with what my background was, so...
So what we have, describe the painting for us.
Yeah, this was actually part of an anomaly series where I was sort of examining what normalcy was in areas of neurological, race, and physical abnormalities or anomalies. So this is conjoined sisters. One is Caucasian and the other is African-American. They're conjoined at the waist and they're sort of hovering surrealistically over a kind of gloomy sea.
Is this something you have to pursue or examine first as an artist? Is race the first question because we're in the United States, because this is America? Do we have to, if you're African-American or mixed race, examine the question of identity first through the prism of race?
I think, you know, just for myself, I think it's always been a struggle again because I think I identified one way and looked another. And so, you know, it was an opportunity to me really kind of voice that sort of inner aspect of myself, and so it was very important to me, and it's less important to me now. I think the works have moved on a little bit, but I think initially that was very important.
And you started doing your work, Betty, at a time when racial politics was in great ferment. Is that something that informed your work as you began?
No, I began sort of moving out from that early etching and being involved with the mystical arts of palmistry and phrenology and all those charts and the images that they evoked and kind of the magic of everyday life. And it wasn't until after the death of Martin Luther King in the late 60s that I really began to feel this kind of resentment of the position that African Americans were placed in, and began collecting derogatory images of African Americans, and then moving into the Aunt Jemima thing and sort of changing that around, making that a positive image. And some of those things continue in my work now, but I feel the yearning to get back to the spirituality and the mysticism.
So why don't we take a look, and we'll go through into the next section, which is interpreting stereotype, and talk a little bit about that. You mentioned Aunt Jemima, and you've got a work here that appears to be dealing with stereotypes. Talk a little bit about The Old Folks at Home.
The Old Folks at Home is, of course, from, Stephen Foster song. And I found this case and this cutout by... maybe a student who had cut out a couple with their arms around each other, and I put in the case with cotton balls and this music and a watermelon and all the things that African Americans were associated with. But also in the background are two rifles, so it's about revolting against those images. And then later on in the 80s, I went back to those images with the Aunt Jemima figure again, having it on a washboard about the role of women domestics and revolting against that imagery and that stigma of still being an Aunt Jemima, regardless of what you were trying to do and evolve.
Yeah, this one I would call Jemima with an attitude. She's packing.
That's right. You know, the rifle is no longer strong enough. And it says extreme times call for extreme heroines. And it seems like we're still in extreme times because racism still prevails.
She is holding in her hand. She's adopted the Jemima posture with the hands on hips. But in those hands are two apparently automatic weapons.
Yes, correct.
She's updated her weaponry here. It's like,
but still that charming smile. She looks as friendly, loving as ever. And Allison, tell us about Strange Fruit.
Well, what we're looking at is a life-size female figure. Actually, she'd be quite tall, about 6 feet tall. And she's caressing herself, holding the breast in one hand and covering her genitals with the other. And she's hanging upside down. She's tied by her ankles by a rope. I titled her Strange Fruit, which, of course, was a song made famous by Billie Holiday about, the horrific lynchings that were, still really prevalent in the United States.
Southern trees bear a strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root, black bodies swinging in the southern breeze, strange fruit hanging from the poplar tree.
And the time I did this piece, it was a time where a lot of women of color and African American women, black women, were on the cover of magazines, and all of a sudden it was kind of like the nation was embracing black beauty. But at the same time, it felt to me like it was this sort of imperialist view, this sort of courting the exotic. And so in this case, Strange Fruit is something like a luscious, strange, exotic piece of fruit that's supposed to be plucked and eaten. And so it still felt very sort of hostile and still, very invasive, and that it was just something to kind of adore and be interested in just because it was exotic and strange. And I think there's still, the media still has this sort of fascination of, black women with large lips, and I think actually the fashion white women started kind of courting that as well. And I don't think there's really been a true embracing of, people of colors being beautiful. It's still kind of this strange sort of twisted approach to it. Yeah.
Tell me about the materials. What is this made of?
I carve all the pieces out of wood. I use a chainsaw, and then I cover them. This is covered with ceiling tin, which is the pressed tin that you find mostly on the ceilings, mostly on the other side of this side of the Mississippi. I like it because it becomes a skin, and it looks almost like keloiding or scarification, which is an African tradition and which tells stories and kind of creates your scars become your story. And I also like that idea that she's scarred, but with these sort of her histories and things like that.
It is a striking piece. And the first thing I noticed once I got past the sort of stark imagery of someone dying like this was the fact that her hand was between her legs. And I wondered about that. Then I looked behind and I saw, oh, there's the Medici Venus. That's precisely the image, precisely the pose, except she's upside down.
Right, that, and then also traditionally women with odalisques is sort of, it's kind of this confusing whether it's a false modesty or if it's provoking. And so it's this kind of mixed message, whether she's actually covering or somehow enticing your eyes to that area.
So, Allison and Leslie, let me ask you both if you ever worry about showing a piece to your mother, that you're going to hear something you don't want to hear. I'll start with you, Allison.
Oh, I think I got over the naked lady thing pretty quickly. Oh, she has some pretty out there stuff, too. She's gone through her erotic series, so not so much that. I think we've always been really open and honest with each other about all sorts of things. And I think because we're always really close and talking about things, there aren't any dark secrets that are leaping off the page, so to speak. So.
Well, and I wondered more in terms of just critique, if it just as one artist to another, but in this case, it's your mother, if it would be a greater sting, if there are things you say, hey, she's not going to like this, I'm not going to show her.
I don't know so much about that. I think sometimes she may question the ideas or themes. I did a series on rap artists, a bunch of gangster, West Coast gangster rap artists, which I don't think was exactly her favorite series, you know. But, mostly I think it's always from a very, our artistic, like not so much thematically what we choose, but her keen eye, and that we always value and want to hear.
Yeah, I think that really she's a mother first when it comes down to looking to our work, and she's always like, very supportive. She's, I think, our biggest, you know, really a stage mom in some respects, in that she's always really pushed us out there and things like that as well. And so, no, she's always actually been very kind. She, in fact, maybe too soft for a real critic, I think.
Well, she needs some pretty giant refrigerator magnets to put your stuff on.
Right, exactly.
Well, thank you very much. It's been great talking with you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
That's the state of things for today. Thanks for listening. If you have a comment about the show, you can drop us an email at sot@wunc.org. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.